It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in.
Eric Bischoff is an idiot.
We have 2 more hours of this.
Maybe the single stupidest idiot that ever got into wrestling.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
You know, when you see Ryback and Disco Inferno trending on Twitter, as soon as I saw the trending tab, I just shook my head because these two know exactly what they're doing and people keep falling for it. They keep giving them exactly what they want. They say stupid shit. It's the only thing they can do to stay relevant. Ryback went after Vince McMahon in a tweet. He brought his mother into things. I'm not even going to repeat what he said. He is endlessly complaining that Twitter and Instagram are shadow banning him and they're suppressing his posts, when the sad reality is, nobody gives a damn what Ryback has to say. That's why his posts don't get any traction. Nobody cares. Which is why we end up with a tweet like the one that he posted this weekend. It's the only way to keep his name out there because no wrestling company wants to work with him. So these two will waste no more of my time, or yours, because we have more important business to transact here. It is episode 754 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, May 1st, 2022. 10 talents gone from NXT in the latest round of Black Friday cuts. Ember Moon speaks out on her final months in WWE and the changes that took place with NXT, particularly after Triple H had his cardiac episode and went away. And the winner-take-all tag team title unification match at WrestleMania Backlash is officially off. Or is it? I've got some things to say about that as well. I was watching the Defy Wrestling show last night, Wild Ones, which aired live on the Pro Wrestling Channel on Pluto TV, channel 732. For those who don't know, you should bookmark it. There were a few hiccups with the live feed early, but it seemed to, you know, settle for the most part. It seemed to run fine. It was a fun show. I thought I had it on in the background while I was working. You know, that Nick Wayne kid, I know we've seen him in GCW and some other places. He just turned 17 years old. He should not be as good as he is. But I was watching the Jon Moxley, Filthy Tom Lawler main event. Both guys got double juice, and I passed out before the end. So I have no idea what happened after that. You go on most of the main wrestling sites, you don't even see anything about the show. I couldn't even find the results on a lot of the main wrestling sites. I'm going to take a wild guess and say that Jon Moxley eked out the win. And it sounds like New Japan had a very eventful wrestling dontaku show this morning. I won't give out any match spoilers here, but 4 new champions crowned, including a new IWGP United States champion, which was vacant after Sonata previously vacated the title due to injury. It was supposed to be Will Ospreay challenging the former champion Hiroshi Tanahashi for the title, but Ospreay caught the COVID this week. And he was not allowed on the show. He was not allowed to travel. So he was replaced instead by Tomohiro Ishii. There was one nice swerve on that show involving another name that I won't mention. I'm going to try to give the show a watch after I'm done here. But there was no time since I had to wake up and get ready for this show here so I can talk to all of you. And many of you, of course, have also been supporting all week, and I thank you for that. If you want to make a PayPal donation entirely voluntary, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the link, the text link right there at the top of the page. It's going to smack you right in the face when you log on. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. I want to say thank you to awesome Anthony Anguiano, supporting as always. He would also like to send a very special happy birthday shout out to his middle brother, Chris, who turned 33 yesterday. He's a huge fan of Chris Jericho and Triple H. And in fact, he is one of the rare fans, I'm told, of Triple H's Reign of Terror. So he's the one. And he loved it when Jericho won the Undisputed title. I will try not to hold that Reign of Terror stuff against him. I will wish Chris a very happy birthday. We have the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, who went above and beyond this week, showing love for the show. Paul's a quality human being. Every time I hear from him, he's always so positive, no matter what it's about. He always looks at the positive side of things. I need that. I need that balance in my life. Paul balances things out for the Solemn Monster. So, Paul, thank you. Night Stalker, Naif Al-Safar. Thank you, brother. Big B, Brian Becerra. Out of Control, Cody Thomas. Beast Mode, Brock Joseph. Killshot, Keith Hart. The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray. New York Punk, Arnold Modesto. Hey, Arnold. Thank you. John Raging Mad Riffle, the Firebomber Craig Foster, Ostentatious, Alan Carter, Alan, my man, thank you. The Iowan Corn Farmer, Jesse Lampier, the Vegemite Delight, Benjamin Cathery, Shin Superkick Akuma, and Jake the Snake Harrison. His dog Layla passed away this week. She gave his family 17 years of joy and was the best pup anybody could ask for. It's always hard losing a pet. It's a long time, but not long enough, right? It never feels long enough. So I'm sorry to hear that, Jake. I had a good time hanging out with all of our Sound Off channel members, the ones who were able to make it on Thursday night. We did a brand new episode of Better Call Saul the Monster. I opened up the phone lines. I don't do that too often anymore, but I do it for channel members. And I didn't know if we were going to go 20 minutes, an hour, 15 minutes. We went 90 minutes. And you guys had some good questions, and I want to thank everybody who joined. That is in the archives for those channel members who may have missed it. Also, brand new Sound Off Gamer went up earlier this week. Well over an hour, My Rise, Episode 4. People seem to be enjoying the return of Sound Off Gamer. I'm enjoying the return of Sound Off Gamer. It's been too long. As I continue on my journey now, I have been demoted to Monday Night Raw. I have been demoted to the main roster. I can only imagine what lies ahead in my future. So I'll try to get episode 5 up at some point this week. And just wanted to let everybody know that is where you can find all of that content. A lot of good content on the YouTube channel, but we got some top story content here on the main show, because that's what we do here. And unfortunately, it's not all great news. For some, it'll be great news, because a lot of these people will be just fine. But it's still sad whenever you hear about stuff like this. On Friday, Sean Ross Sapp of Fightful reported that NXT releases were coming. It's like the British are coming. So that was an ominous message. And then minutes later came the news. They delayed this by 2 weeks. Every year. At least the last couple of years. April 15th. Post-WrestleMania cut. They literally waited just an extra 2 weeks. But we knew this was coming. We knew this was inevitable. 10 names in all, for now. Dakota Kai was given her walking papers, as was Malcolm Bivens of Diamond Mine, although Sapp says the company asked him to re-sign in February, and he made it clear to them that he did not want to. And the same for Dakota Kai. She was not keen on re-signing with them either. Dexter Lumis is gone. Persia Parada, who apparently just bought a new house in the last few weeks. Never a good time to lose your job, but especially not after moving into your new home when you've got a mortgage to pay. And also, in her case, probably when you're here on a work visa and you lose your job. That makes things even more dicey. Just ask the Iconics. Harland is gone, which would explain why he hasn't been on TV with Joe Gacy the past 2 weeks. Draco Anthony, who's made a handful of appearances on NXT. Raylan Devine, who is the sister of Mace, or Dio Madden. She's 6'3". She's 6'3", former basketball player. I would have remembered seeing her on TV, but she never made it that far. The rest of them I've never heard of before. Sanjana George, Mila Milani, and Paige Prinzavalli, who was a referee there named Blair Baldwin. This was said to be a John Laurinaitis decision, and the reason given was, say it with me now, budget cuts. Budget cuts, pal, sorry. Nothing personal. Just budget cuts. Yes, one NXT official contacted Fightful and expressed frustration that several angles and acts and stories were affected by the cuts with little to no notice or preparation. Well, I mean, outside of Harlan, I mean, Harlan's been missing for 2 weeks. I think they had to know something was up with him. Dakota Kai, let's take this step by step here. Start with Dakota Kai. Dakota Kai was done for when she had those tryout matches at SmackDown last year and was never called up. She worked with Aaliyah last summer, who did get called up. And then they had Dakota work at least one match that I remember with Cora Jade in November. And she wound up right back in NXT. Vince McMahon saw no main roster potential in Dakota Kai. And per Fightful, her deal was set to expire in April of next year. And once the dark matches came and went, and she wasn't called up, she made it clear that she would not be re-signing with them when her deal was up. So they cut her. You know, the magic number here is 33. That's how old Dakota Kai is. 33 years old. That, as much as anything, I believe, is a reason as to why they didn't see any main roster potential in her. You know, once Triple H was gone, that was the beginning of the end for Dakota Kai. I mean, look what they were doing with her on television before then as compared to after. They didn't seem to know what they were doing with her. She didn't really fit into their new plans for the brand. She started acting crazy and she was talking to herself. I mean, that's what working in WWE sometimes will do to you. It'll drive you nuts. You'll start talking to yourself. She fell out of place. You know, she felt out of place with the relaunch and that whole silly gimmick. Now, they did make her and Raquel the tag team champions at Stand and Deliver, even though it was only for a few days. But they won the titles, and then she had that TV match a few weeks ago to put over Mandy Rose. That was her exit. So, I mean, her name being on the list really wasn't shocking at all. And if you listen to the interview that Ember Moon did with Chris Van Vliet, which dropped this week, and I'm going to be talking about that in a few minutes, watch that interview and the way that Athena describes some of the changes that were made in NXT after the reboot. You listen to that, nobody should be surprised that they got rid of somebody like Dakota Kai. She posted on social media, "I don't know what's next for me. I chose Evie, the name Evie, at 17 years old. That chapter is shut. Just know this, I'm far from being done." She is going to be a quality addition to any women's roster. Wherever she lands, Dakota Kai is going to be just fine. Malcolm Bivens. The bad news is that Malcolm Bivens is dead. The good news is that Stokely Hathaway is very much alive. Like Dakota, his contract was also set to expire next year. And there was a pitch to bring him up to the main roster as the manager for Omos on Monday Night Raw. And he passed on the idea. LA Knight was said to also be considered for the role. Ultimately, they decided to go a different way with him. He's with Mace now and Mansoor and the dark matches and doing the whole modeling agency gimmick. We'll see if they bring that to TV soon. So they took him in a different direction. And they turned to MVP instead. And they put MVP with Omos. Malcolm Bivens would have done his damnedest to get the big guy over. But even Bivens is not a miracle worker. Malcolm Bivens is great, but he's no miracle man. There's only so much that can be done when it comes to Omos. If he saw that as a dead end for his own career, then good on him for standing his ground if that's how he felt. You know, it's rare that you hear that they did want to bring somebody up to Raw or SmackDown and they had an idea for them and that person told them, "No, I'm not interested. Sorry, I think I'll pass." But it's clear that he wanted out of there and he got his wish, albeit a year earlier than he probably was expecting. You know, Hathaway is very talented with a microphone in his hand. He's got a sharp tongue, very much a throwback to some of the old school wrestling managers, even down to getting in the ring the way Bobby Heenan used to do when his wrestling days were long since over and WWE would put him in those weasel suit matches with the Ultimate Warrior where he would just get his ass kicked and take bumps. You know, he's done that on indie shows before. Like Dakota Kai, not only is he going to be fine, now he'll have a chance to shine even brighter, not being relegated to the C-show. He's also got a history with a very interesting individual, that person being MJF. Hathaway once led a stable that MJF was part of in Beyond Wrestling. Not that MJF needs somebody to talk for him, but to see the two of them reunited in some form would make for some great television. Dexter Lumis was a surprise to me, but it probably shouldn't have been. He's 38 years old, which worked against him more than any other single factor. The storyline leading up to the wedding with him and Indy Hartwell, I thought was, you know, for the most part, it was entertaining. Once they got married, they really needed to either move him up to the main roster or move him into something more meaningful. And instead, it just felt like they didn't know what to do with him and they were kind of treading water. You know, it's like the dog that catches the car. It got the car and now it doesn't know what to do with itself. Even when he spoke his first words at the wedding, it would have made sense naturally to progress his character to where he would actually be talking more on television. And instead, he went right back to being the nonverbal mute. You know, in the ring, he was capable, and I think he at least deserved a look at for a spot on Raw or SmackDown. He never even had the chance. I'm curious to see now if he sticks with a similar character in his next company or on the indies, wherever he goes to next, because he's basically been playing a version of the same serial killer, stalker type persona since his Sam Shaw days in TNA. He's been doing it for almost a decade now across two different companies. God, Sam Shaw. Sam Shaw and the gut check days. Holy shit, that's taken me back. Taking me back to the Impact Review days of the podcast. Parker Boudreaux was released, better known as Harland. Baby Brock, as a lot of people called him when he was first signed, because he bore a striking resemblance to a young Brock Lesnar. Even Paul Heyman once endorsed him in a tweet, told people to bookmark the tweet for historical significance. Historical reference. Come back to this tweet years from now. He might still end up looking like a genius because Harlan's only 24 years old. And if he wants to keep doing this, he could still end up being a star one day. Today is not that day. They signed him, they changed his name, they had him shave his head, so he no longer looked anything like Brock Lesnar. And then they fired him. So it was a hell of a run. Now, he could always work indies and get more seasoning. Maybe that's what they encouraged him to do. I don't know. But it's funny because they don't seem to want anybody from the indies anymore, right? They're, at the very least, they're severely toning down the number of indie wrestlers they want to bring in. Nick Khan flat out said that. So if he goes out and he ends up working indies all over the country, or if he branches out and works indies and other promotions all over the world and learns all kinds of different styles, which frankly I think is something that makes a lot of sense for everybody to be doing, that would seem to fly in the face of their new edict. It's one of the reasons why that new edict is not going to last. Like so many other Vince McMahon decrees over the years, they come and go depending on what side of the bed he wakes up on. Remember years ago, it was like, we're not looking for anybody under 6'2", 240 pounds. How long did that last? How long did that? Not very long. Once they realize over time, and they will, that the level of ring-ready talent has fallen off considerably, they'll be right back to the indies. They'll be right back plucking people out of the indies. You watch. It's only a matter of time. Harlan wasn't very good. But he was training for what, a year? I think maybe a year, a little over a year. He was still new at this. Which is the entire point of their developmental system, to develop these people. Evidently, they didn't think he was developing fast enough. Remember the Athletic interview I referenced last week with Triple H and those quotes about the 2.0 relaunch? A lot of the double talk that we heard in there. He said something else in that interview that was, I think, very telling, maybe about Harland and some of the other names. He said, because they're bringing in now so many younger names, it forces them to make quicker decisions on how well a talent is progressing. He said, now it just takes them 6 months to know whether or not somebody has an aptitude for this. They announced Harlan's signing over a year ago. Now it's 6 months and you're gone if they feel you're not up to snuff. Maybe they didn't think he was up to snuff. They had seen enough. But they didn't even make any attempt to explain his absence from television or to write him off the show. It's just, poof, he's gone. Persia Parada, also gone. Wasn't doing much actual wrestling on TV, but she was involved with the silly romance storyline with Duke Hudson, Dexter Lumis, and Indy Hartwell. Now two of the four are gone. Indy is without her husband, and Hudson's without his girlfriend. I guess that means Indy and Duke now have to become a couple now. Those are the rules. That's how it works. You know, Draco Anthony, he had some size to him, but I didn't see enough of him to say that, you know, there was anything about him that really stood out to me. The other names on the list, a lot of them had not even appeared on television yet. So I don't really have an opinion one way or the other on the other ones. As you have heard me say before, why invest your time in a show where they end up disregarding so much of what happens on that show? This is one of the problems, the big problems now with NXT. Even when NXT was actually developmental the first time, because they started out that way, they started out as developmental. Over time, Triple H raided the indies, he raided Ring of Honor, and he brought in all these guys, a lot of smaller guys, but he brought a lot of guys in with experience, 10, 15 years of experience, and created his own super indie, and that's, the takeovers blew up, and it became, you know, really the best, most entertaining brand, and certainly also from an in-ring standpoint, the best television that WWE was producing at its peak. You know, the peak of the black and gold era was just fantastic. But a lot of that was built around the more experienced talent. I think there was a middle ground there where you could keep some of that more experienced talent and start mixing in, start doing a better job of mixing in the ones that don't have any experience so they can work with people who do. I didn't think you had to blow the whole fucking thing up. But even if you go back to when NXT was developmental the first time and was airing on the network every week and not USA, I don't remember there being this level of turnover and all of the constant ridiculous name changes after they've already been introduced on television. It's one thing to sign somebody, and before they even make it to TV and they start running vignettes, you give them a new name, right? They've been doing that for years. But I can't remember there being a period where so many people who were already established on television, even if it was only NXT, all the name changes, and like I said, between that and the turnover and the people being cut, this is new. This is new ground that we're on here. I mean, just imagine for a moment that you were in a coma, okay? God forbid you were cleaning out your kitchen cabinet and a blender fell out right on top of your head and knocked you unconscious. You wake up in the hospital a month later, you turn on NXT, and you see Diamond Mine, but no Malcolm Bivens. You see Joe Gacy, but no Harland. Where's the big guy that was with Joe Gacy? What happened to him? Now he's got druids, like he's the new Undertaker. You see Legado del Fantasma, and you could have sworn that that guy was called Raul Mendoza the last time you watched the show. And you're wondering to yourself, why are they calling him Cruz del Toro? Why is Casey Catanzaro running around calling herself Katana Chance? Why is Kaylee Ray walking around with a flaming baseball bat calling herself Alba Fire? How long have I been unconscious for? What alternate timeline did I wake up in? This is NXT now. But let's talk about Athena. The former Ember Moon did an interview with Chris Van Vliet that dropped on his channel this week. It's a little over an hour long. It's really good. And she addressed her final frustrating months in WWE before her release last November. And it was a very revealing look behind the scenes when it comes to the NXT women and the changes following the brand relaunch in September. Credit to Fightful for the transcription, but I want to read you some of the key parts of this, and I'll give you my thoughts on the back end of it here. She said, "My last 4 months was just one of those moments where I wasn't having fun anymore. It started with Shotzi being gone and drafted. I was sitting at home and got a phone call saying, 'Hey, we don't want you to be upset, but Shotzi just got moved to SmackDown, and she's debuting with Tegan Knox as a tag team.' I was sitting there getting this phone call about her getting drafted, thinking, 'Oh my God, I'm so happy for her.' And then the tag team thing popped up, and I was like, 'But we're the tag team, and we have merch.' They were like, 'Don't worry, we have something for you.' She said, okay, cool. I remember going to Hunter and he was like, I have no clue what's happening. We'll figure it out together. How many times do you think Triple H has said that when a concerned talent has come to him about a call-up or something, they're going to change something about their character or something, goes, I have no idea what's happening. Don't look at me. We're finding out about this together at the same time. I'm sure he's had that conversation many times with lots of talents. Bayley had gotten injured. I know Shotzi and Tegan were doing dark matches for a tryout anyway. The problem I had was that some of these new writers were coming from Raw and SmackDown telling me, we had no idea that you and Shotzi were a tag team. A lot of WWE backstage is having to play the game. It's cool, we get it, we're down in NXT. It's not like we were front page of the website when we won the titles or anything. That's fine. You're just having to eat the shit sandwich and smile with shit in your teeth a lot of times. It's all about not making waves. After Shotzi was moved to the main roster, Ember said that she came up with a storyline for herself that could also help some of the younger talent. She said, me, Hunter, and the head writer at the time had come up with doing a heel turn with me because it was new and different. During this process, we wanted to do a losing streak. That was my thought. Let me do the losing streak. I see the new faces coming through, and part of my job at NXT was to help the new talent on TV, which I get. I love this business so much that I didn't mind. Let me do the losing streak, let me get frustrated, and let me turn. They said, this is a great idea. We have ABCD, we'll do your first feud with this person. Then the first match happened, and I'm off TV for 4 weeks. Don't worry, we got this. Then Hunter disappeared. I was supposed to do a match with Saray and ended up getting a rash on my arm. I had an allergic reaction to something, and they thought it was something else. So they pulled me from the match. Okay, fine. We'll do the match next week. 3 weeks later, we're going to do this match. That match gets pulled from TV, and one of the head coaches goes, will you do me a favor and work 205 Live with Cora Jade? We like her. She's a sweet girl. We think this will be a fun match. You two are in the main event. Cool. That sounds great. I'm never going to say no to having a match on TV, regardless of where it's airing. We have a fun banger of a match. They go, you're turning in this match, but we want to make it subtle. So they kind of turn me, but they don't. There was confusion about what would happen. Then I'm off TV for 3 weeks. I have the match with Mandy Rose, and they're like, we're finally pulling the trigger on this. I get a note that week saying, in 2 weeks, we need you to dye your hair the fire color again, get the red contacts. You're going back to the old Ember Moon character. This is straight from Vince. You're going to turn heel, but turn heel as your old character. We're trying to get the old music and stuff together. All right, this is great. I show up to TV. I'm motivated, just had to wait it out. Ryan Katz and I went and filmed a demo of the vibe that I wanted. We come back. I get the video ready. I'm ready to show everybody on TV. And they're like, hey, we got some bad news. Vince is pulling you off TV indefinitely. And this is where she started getting emotional during the interview when you watch it. She said, I just sat there and was like, what did I do wrong? I've done everything you guys have asked me. I've gone over and above. When they put me and Shotzi in a tag team, everybody knows I'm not a tag team person. I hate tag teams. There's too many moving parts. It's not that I hate tag team wrestling. It just requires so much more to give as opposed to just relying on yourself. Now you have to rely on three other people. I feel me and Shotzi capitalized on it. We were so motivated to build that division, and then we weren't able to. When you care about something, not just for yourself, but for everybody involved, it hurts so much more, because for so many years, I've not been about myself. I've been for the match and for other people. To be told that I've done nothing wrong, and I was taken off TV for doing nothing wrong, it hurts so bad because I was so happy walking into work. I remember when Shotzi left, I remember going to my makeup artist and saying, I'm so unhappy. We would have to sit through stupid meetings about how we would have to dress sexy. I cater to children. I'm not about to wear fishnet booty butt cheek shorts because we had a 2-hour meeting about how to dress like Mandy Rose. That's not fair. Mandy is absolutely phenomenal and an amazing person, but not everybody is Mandy Rose. I started seeing this downslope as soon as Hunter was gone. I got so angry, sitting there thinking I did nothing wrong. I didn't piss off Vince. They took Shotzi away. Hunter is gone. You guys promised me this wouldn't happen. You promised I wouldn't be lost in the shuffle. I went on this losing streak to help you out and build other talent so I could get a reward. They're like, not everything is lost, Ember. We still want you to come and help the next generation, maybe teach a class. And I'm like, you're taking me off TV and trying to make me a coach? If I've done nothing wrong, you can cancel all my flights. I'm not coming to help these people who don't care about what I do. They only care about the paycheck that hits their bank account. They're not passionate like me. I'm not going to come up here and help these people that don't care about what we do when there's no benefit in it for me, when I've done nothing wrong. And I've given you my entire right side of my body between my elbow surgery and my Achilles. I've given you this entire side of my body for no reward. You want to take me off TV to coach? I was supposed to come to NXT for a repackaging and then go back to the main roster. That was supposed to be within the year, and I'm still here. You took Shotzi away from me. I have nothing to go off of. I'm going home. Cancel all my flights. Cancel all my hotels. If you have a flight, but no creative for me, I'm not getting on. I'm not doing this anymore because I'm going to snap. I'm going to go home. If you need me, I'll be there. Even then, I need to approve the creative before I hop on the flight. She said it's the first time that she ever pulled that card. And then in the last little bit here, she said, I think I just quit. For 3 months, I had been saying, I think I'm going to quit today. And then I actually did, I think. And she again mentioned the meetings. She could see what was going on with the booty butt cheek meeting and then telling the girls to alter their gear to make it more revealing. Some people were very uncomfortable with that, and they were like, nope, this is what they want, you have to do it. It didn't matter how that person felt. This isn't what I signed up for anymore. This isn't about the wrestling or the art that we create in the ring. This is turning into everything I left on Raw and SmackDown. The pity party started forming in the locker rooms, the jealousy, the cattiness. Why is this person on TV? I'm just sitting there like, I'm an adult. I can't deal with this high school bullshit. You hear those comments, and if all you do is read the transcript or you hear me, you know, talking about what she said here secondhand, you're going to have, and I already see it on social media, you're going to have people who say, oh, she's just being bitter. Oh my God, how bitter Ember Moon is. She's just bitter that she got fired. She's just bitter they decided to push other women ahead of her. She's bitter that plans change and she didn't get what she wanted and she's whining and complaining. I urge you, watch the interview for yourself, even if only the part where she talks about this. And that's not the entire interview. She only got into this because Chris asked her a question. And she said, oh, okay, well, I guess we're going to get into this now. And it was about 15 minutes of her talking about this out of an hour and 15 minute interview. I urge you, watch the interview for yourself. Hear her tell it in her own voice. She spent most of it wiping away tears and snot. You know, I mean, you could tell that it still bothers her, not out of bitterness, but because she was constantly lied to and fucked around. You'd be angry too if that were you. And shit like that happens all the time, not just in WWE, not just in wrestling, but just in life. In the corporate world. I'm not saying this is something that is exclusive only to WWE. But boy, it sure seems to happen there quite a bit. You'd be angry too if you were in her shoes. It's maddening to listen to. And it's not surprising to me that the main roster writers pay no attention to NXT storylines. So a lot of what happens there gets totally disregarded once they get called up. She didn't even get into how she got hurt. She mentioned the Achilles. She didn't even get into how she got hurt when she ruptured her Achilles, which was a terrible injury. Kept her out for over a year. She thought her career might be over. It was a very bad rupture. Single-handedly knocked her off the main roster. She went back to NXT when she came back. She never did make it back to Raw or SmackDown. She didn't tell the story. How did it happen? It happened doing a chase for the 24/7 title. Her career almost ended chasing after the 24/7 joke belt. She wasn't even supposed to be working that night. She had worked a Raw match the night before. They called her and said, look, we need you to work the next night. And that's what they had her doing. A foot race. With the usual brigade of losers on TV, chasing after the ugly green belt. You could see where the wheels began to fall off when Triple H disappeared. The stuff about the talent meetings, telling the women to dress sexier after the 2.0, relaunch, it's not surprising to anybody who watches the show now. The whole show is just built on sex appeal. They're trying to appeal to a younger audience and think, well, we'll attract an audience just by making it raunchier. That'll solve everything. Fightful learned of the meetings months ago but could not get anybody to confirm them at the time. They were scheduled under the guise of fashion consulting. They brought in a consultant named Melanie Pace to conduct the meetings. Several talents were said to be upset that these meetings happened, and they blamed them on John Laurinaitis. But Fightful has not been able to confirm if he had anything to do with it. One talent said they were encouraged to dress that way backstage also, not just on TV. And although dress sexier wasn't outright said, they said that it was implied. Hey, that's kind of like years ago when the steroid stuff was running rampant in WWE and there was the steroid trial. And there were people who were asked, were you specifically told to take steroids? Were you specifically told to get on the gas? And a lot of people said, well, no, it wasn't necessarily articulated to me verbatim like that, but it was kind of implied that, you got to get bigger, or it'll help your career if you get bigger. I've heard Jim Ross even back then, when he was in the company, talk about this guy he's got to bulk up, he needs more size. People can take that any number of ways. There are times where things are said without being said. It sounds like that's what happened here too. Numerous women refused to go to the meetings at all. There's nothing wrong with the women dressing that way, dressing sexier if they want to, and especially if it fits their character on TV. Toxic Attraction has been one of the most pushed acts since the 2.0 relaunch. And it really, it's given Mandy Rose the biggest run of her entire career so far. And she plays the part perfectly in terms of how she presents herself and all the members of Toxic Attraction. That's kind of what they do. They dress sexy, and that's kind of the whole gimmick. So for some people it works, but it's not necessarily meant for everybody. If it works for your character on TV, then hey, go for it. But to be told, well, you've got to dress a certain way and be more revealing whether you want to or not, tough shit, this is what you have to do. And then they're dressing it up as fashion consulting. Coming from the same people who gave you the women's revolution that they love to talk about so much. It's such a huge marketing tool for the women's revolution in WWE. You can see the hypocrisy there. All these women that are there now or that are coming in, right? They see Charlotte Flair and Sasha Banks and Bayley and Becky Lynch. They didn't come into the company as plastic Barbie dolls. They came in there along with Asuka and others, and they ushered in this era of women's wrestling that was different than any other in the history of that company. All under Triple H's watch. There are women who saw that and said, that's what I want to do. I want to be like that. I didn't think wrestling was for someone like me because... And we heard even some of those women say that. They grew up watching Trish Stratus and other women of that era who were pushed because of how they looked. And Trish turned into a hell of a wrestler. But that was a very different time in WWE. The Attitude Era, the post-Attitude Era. It was kind of the Wild West there for a while. Yeah, hell, young Solomonster when I'm in my teens watching that shit. I love it. It's great, right? That's the audience they were appealing to. It was just a very different time. But there were a lot of women who saw that who probably were like, I don't look like that. I can't do this. And maybe they decided to go do something else with their lives. But then when they started to see some of these other women being pushed because they were actually able to work, all of a sudden it's like, oh, wow, it kind of opens up the door maybe for me to come in and do that. Even though I don't, look a certain way, I can do that. So you have all these women who wanted to come in and train and go to the PC because they thought that that's what they could do. They sign up for what they think is their dream job. Triple H then gets taken out of the picture. All of a sudden, you have Vince McMahon and Bruce Pritchard and John Laurinaitis And we'll throw Kevin Dunn in there too while we're at it, the sick fuck. The GQ cover models that they all are. Reverting back to the good old diva days. Some revolution, huh? Ember sounded very open to going to AEW when she was asked about it, but said it's not her call to make. And you know, Tony Khan has brought in Ruby Soho, and Tony Storm has not featured them much recently outside of the Owen Hart qualifiers. Ruby spends most of her time now on Dark Elevation on YouTube. But she did debut in the Casino Battle Royal at All Out, which she won. She wrestled Britt Baker for the women's title at Arthur Ashe Stadium. She made it all the way to the finals of the TBS title tournament against Jade Cargill before she lost. So I don't think it's entirely fair to say they've done nothing with her. That's not true. But she hasn't wrestled a match on Dynamite since the beginning of February. Today's May 1st. Athena going to AEW doesn't automatically mean that she'll be back on television every week, but it would give her the chance to be on TV, again with a major promotion. And she is very good. In WWE, her best work came during her first run with NXT, not her main roster run. If you want a couple of matches to go watch, go check out her TakeOver Brooklyn match with Asuka. I forget which Brooklyn show it was. Or the match that she had with Shayna Baszler when she lost the title before she got called up. But I thought she came across very likable during the interview, not bitter at all, even though you read those comments and you would think it's all negative, all bitter. Again, I urge you to take the time to go watch it yourself with your own eyes. She came across to me as somebody who has just been waiting a long time to vent and get a lot off her chest that she's been holding in for quite some time. But I thought it was a very good interview and very insightful. AEW World Champion Hangman Adam Page missed Dynamite on Wednesday after testing positive for COVID-19. Not only did the AEW champion miss the show, but as I said at the beginning of the podcast, Will Ospreay tested positive. He was pulled from his scheduled match earlier today with Hiroshi Tanahashi at the New Japan show. Hangman's absence caused some rewriting to be done for Dynamite and Rampage this week, but they did make the announcement, they did make it official, that at Double or Nothing, later this month, it will be Hangman Page defending the AEW world title against CM Punk. And so the stage is now set for the idea that I talked about, you know, a few months ago, where Punk goes to, I don't know if they were going to do it, honestly, a Double or Nothing or find a way to hold out until Chicago in September for All Out. But Punk goes on to win the championship from Hangman and then eventually drop the title to MJF. I mean, the story is right there. It's right there for the taking. You know, Punk could win the title in Vegas. He would then, if he did, would go into the Forbidden Door pay-per-view in Chicago as the champion. But he has to win the title for the story to work that I pitched. Which goes back to even before Revolution. I said MJF loses at Revolution, which he did. Punk then goes on to win the title. And then MJF, when he beats Punk to close out their story arc, when he does that, he wins the AEW World Championship for the first time. Punk has to win that title for the story to work. Although somebody in the live chat the other night floated an alternate idea. What if MJF eventually beat Hangman? And not Punk to win the title, with the idea being that MJF would beat the man who holds wins over CM Punk, Bryan Danielson, and Kenny Omega. So instead of MJF beating Punk, he's beating the guy who beat Punk. That could work, but I just think it works better if MJF beats Punk straight up, even if that doesn't happen until the end of the year. Yeah, you give Punk a little while, a little run with the title. But eventually, in the end, the idea is that MJF is the one who takes it away from him. We had Dax Harwood and Cash Wheeler. They had a very good match, Owen Hart qualifying match on Wednesday night. Dax went over, so he is officially in the Owen. It was basically a love letter to Bret Hart and Owen to a lesser degree, but let's be honest, it was a love letter to Bret. They replicated multiple spots, including many spots from the WrestleMania 10 match. When I went back after the fact, there were even some spots that I missed. And so they probably went a little too far with it. I do think it probably would have been better for them to kind of create some of their own stuff and not just try to cram in 15 different exact spots in the match, but I still thought it was a good match. I thought it was a nice little homage to one of the greatest matches of all time. Serena Deeb got a win over Hikaru Shida in their Philadelphia street fight. Deeb will now, it's not official yet, but they were heavily teasing Deeb against Thunder Rosa at Double or Nothing for the Women's Championship. That's exactly the match that they should be doing. Rey Fénix, back from his injury. Of course, he got hurt at the beginning of the year. I think it was the very first Dynamite on TBS. And was expecting to be back earlier than he was. We thought we had him locked down. It was going to be the Lucha Bros and the Briscoes at House of Glory back in March. And turned out that Fénix wasn't quite ready to come back yet. There were some other matches as well that he had to pull out of. But he is officially back. In fact, he was wrestling last night at the Triple Mania show. So it's good to have him back. Scorpio Sky, once again, TNT champion for a second time. Boy, I hope this run goes a lot better than his first one did. The worst TNT champion of all time with that first run. Sammy Guevara was hurt, or the belief was that he was hurt, although obviously not too seriously, because he was also at Triple Mania last night, although he didn't wrestle. I'll talk about that in a second. But Sammy was hurt on a very scary corkscrew splash off a ladder that missed Scorpio Sky. That was very scary to watch. He's very lucky he didn't break his neck and that he only hit the back of his head. So maybe that's the injury. Maybe he's concussed. I don't know. But I watched that on Wednesday, and look, there's always inherently a risk when you get in the ring, especially in these kinds of matches. That's nothing new. You go in a ladder match, you dive off a ladder, there's always going to be the risk of injury. My issue increasingly with Sammy, when I see him doing stupid shit like that, it's completely unnecessary. And I know that's part of his gimmick. He points to his head and goes, I'm crazy, and then he does some crazy dive. He's going to fucking kill himself. And there's no reason for it. You could do plenty of big dives and spots and work them into your matches where it makes sense. He just does shit for the sake of doing it. If you go back and you watch it, it was a completely stupid spot. Early in the match, too. It wasn't even like it played into the finish. It almost did. That almost finished the match right there. But yeah, I've gone back and I've watched it. It's so dumb. And I said, I don't feel the same way when I watch Darby Allin. And Darby does some pretty, you know, scary shit in his matches. And takes a lot of abuse and takes a lot of really vicious bumps. Because he seems to enjoy it. Remember that bump down the staircase he took during the pandemic era when they were still running Daly's Place? I mean, he does a lot of really stupid shit. But it's different. When I watch Darby and he's doing a dive or something, I think the way we were describing it on the stream the other night, it's almost like controlled recklessness as opposed to just being reckless. It's hard to describe. I don't want to minimize, you know, watching Darby that like nothing he's doing isn't dangerous, but like it feels like he's in control of his body. He knows what he's doing. He's in control. Sammy just does shit. And it's very, very stupid. And also, look, if you're going to do something like that, you better fucking hit it. He barely grazed Scorpio Sky. He missed him. If you're going to do something like that, you got to hit your target. He didn't even hit his opponent. It just looked stupid all the way around. So he lost one title on Wednesday. He gained a new one last night at Triple Mania. He and Ty Conti won the AAA mixed tag team titles in a match that Sammy didn't even wrestle in. He was out there with a crutch and he uses a weapon. He didn't take any bumps, which makes me think that he either is nursing some kind of an injury or they really just told him, look, play it safe. We don't want you taking any bumps. You can go, but we don't want you taking any bumps. But he is a champion now. He replaced one title with another. We are getting a mini Impact Wrestling Invasion on Dynamite this Wednesday. We have AEW heavily teasing, but they have not outright announced the opponent for Wardlow. MJF, it looks like, is bringing in W. Morrissey for a match against Wardlow, the former Big Cass from WWE, who hit rock bottom in his life. He had, you know, substance abuse issues, and he was in a really bad place and has talked openly about those struggles and fighting back and being sober. And you know, I've heard about some of the work that he's done recently in Impact, and it sounds like he's really turned things around, and he's had a second lease on life and a second lease on his career. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of match those two have. I was very impressed by what I saw from Wardlow in the ring the other night against Lance Archer. The guy's in there doing standing Ranas and stuff that a guy like Wardlow, you wouldn't expect him to be doing. The guy can do it all. So what kind of a match are these two going to have together? We'll see. Again, not announced formally, but they all but said that he would be the opponent. But they also announced that the Ring of Honor Women's Champion, Deonna Purrazzo, who is signed, of course, to Impact Wrestling, will make her AEW debut against the interim Ring of Honor Women's Champion, Mercedes Martinez, who won the title at the Supercard of Honor show at the beginning of last month. Deonna wasn't able to be on the show, so they crowned an interim champion. Now the two of them are going to go one-on-one to crown one unified Ring of Honor Women's Champion. I cannot see both Impact stars losing on the same night, so if one of them has to win, it's going to be Deonna. Jeff Hardy is going to try to win his way into the Owen Hart Cup against Bobby Fish, and if he does, and he should, that opens up the possibility of a Jeff Hardy-Darby Allin match in the tournament after Darby qualified on Friday with a win over Swerve Strickland. So we'll see if they match them up. Maybe in the semifinals or something. That definitely would be an appealing match, I think, to give people in that tournament. The question is, do they want to give that match away now, or is that a match they want to save not for a tournament, but for, you know, television or for pay-per-view, you know, later on down the road? I would love to see it in the tournament. And to follow up on last week's Bret Hart contract news, Bret has since clarified, this is per The Observer, his only deal with WWE at the moment is a merchandising deal. There is no other type of contract that he has signed. It's still not clear if that would stop him from making an appearance in AEW if he wanted to, but it didn't stop him, you know, 3 years ago when they brought him in for the reveal of the AEW World Title Belt. That was the same night where when he left the ring and he was walking to the back, he fell off the stage. Thankfully, he was okay. Those in AEW are under the impression that he is not available legally to them, even if they wanted him. They have not reached out to him. I don't know what leads them to believe that. I don't know what little mole they have in WWE feeding them that information, but apparently that is the impression they are under. I think it's very unlikely that he and Martha, Owen's widow, would share the ring together at Double or Nothing, given that they aren't on the best of terms. But it's at least possible, if he hasn't signed any sort of WWE contract recently, that would prevent him from even just showing up and waving to the crowd, you know, or presenting one of the trophies. It's possible, you know. All Tony Khan has to do is pick up the phone and call him and say, "Hey, Bret, are you legally available? I have an idea for you." You know, you could have Martha presenting the cup to the women's winner and have Bret presenting the cup to the men's winner. I just don't know how likely that is. Other news and notes. Andrew Zarian of the Matt Men podcast reported on Wednesday, a source over at WWE mentioned that WWE intends to run more stadium shows moving forward in 2023. More stadium shows. They're already doing 8 of them this year. They're going to have a stadium show every month at this rate. He says the goal is to make this the new norm. This is a Nick Khan approach when it comes to premium live events. The scalability of large stadiums is very beneficial when it comes to having live attendance over 15,000. The event does not have to be a sellout of 50K plus, but now you have room to do 20 to 35,000 shows more often, leading to a much higher revenue number and higher level of excitement for the event. If they think that they can fill up enough and sell more tickets, they're in business to make money, then that's what they're going to do. I do wish they would keep this is just me personally. I wish they would keep the stadium shows limited to their bigger events, especially for the acoustics. You know, if they start running more stadiums that are half filled, you can fit 65,000, but they're only going to run it so they can get 30 in there. So now you have a half-filled stadium, especially if it's an outdoor venue. The crowd doesn't always sound as loud on TV as it might in the building, but again, that's just a personal thing with me. Look, it makes sense if they think they can sell those tickets. 25,000 is better than 15. That's about all they can set up for with the stage and everything in a lot of these NBA buildings. That's about it. They used to be able to get 20,000 people in the building. They don't do 20,000 anymore. And it's not always because there isn't enough interest. It's because with the giant stage and everything, 14 or 15, maybe 16, that's like the quote-unquote sellout number for them. So if they want 25,000, then yeah, the only option would be to run a much bigger building, but just set it up for 25,000. They think they can do it and they can move the tickets, then go for it. One of those upcoming stadium shows has a name and a logo. The UK show, September 3rd, that's Labor Day weekend, Principality Stadium in Cardiff, will be called Clash at the Castle. It's, I cannot confirm that that is the name that Kevin Castle used to give to his gatherings in his backyard when he would invite all of his fellow podcasters over to watch the pay-per-views and used to call them Clash at the Castle. Clash at the Castle. I like that name. I think it sounds cool. Tickets go on sale Friday, May 20th, with a pre-sale on May 18th. The BBC is reporting that more than 125,000 people have already pre-registered to buy tickets, which is an insane level of demand. Not surprising, 30 years. 30 years to the year since WWE ran a major stadium show like this in that part of the world. So, of course, you have all this pent-up demand. You have a lot of wrestling fans over in the UK. Only half that number will be able to get into the building. So, if you want to be one of those people, my suggestion to you, bookmark those on-sale dates. Have a few different devices ready to go. You got your desktop, you got your laptop, you got your tablet, you got your phone. Get them all set up and ready so you can get your tickets. We've got a couple of legal updates for you this week. Stay off the road. Tammy Sitch remains free after killing a man back in March when she slammed into the back of his car. Police are still awaiting her full toxicology results. They only have partial results so far. Any charges that ultimately might be filed won't take place until after the investigation is completed. But she addressed the incident publicly for the first time on Twitter. When asked by a fan, "How fast were you going when you slammed into the poor old guy, stopped at a traffic light, and killed him? His life ended for what reason? Were you on your way to a fire, or drunk, or high?" Tammy responded, "About 10, as in 10 miles an hour, since I was slowing down." And then the rest of this is almost illegible here. I don't know, she must have been typing this on her phone. She said, "About 10, since I was slowing down to period, light, period, but he had a heart, period, attack, period. Nothing to do with my seizure." So now she's claiming to have had a seizure, which is a stunt that she's pulled before. And she's denying any culpability whatsoever in the man's death. "Wasn't my fault. The man had a heart attack." She claims she was only going 10 miles an hour. If this woman is breathing, she's lying. She sees herself as the victim in this, which is exactly the sort of thing you would expect from a narcissistic sociopath. She was not legally allowed to be driving, regardless of the circumstances. This should be open and shut. A few days later, she tweeted again to say, "Okay, enough. Stop this shit now. This man," that being her boyfriend, "is the most caring man I've ever known. He puts me first before him. It was my car in the accident, not his. So cut the crap. Enough already. Nothing you all say is going to break us up, so just give it a rest. Bye-bye." That flies in the face of the police report, which lists James F. Pente as the owner of the Mercedes that she was driving. The lies never end with this woman. She should probably stay off social media and keep her mouth shut. But if she says something that ends up landing her behind bars sooner, then the world would be a lot safer for it. So by all means, keep tweeting away. And new police video was released this week from Jimmy Uso's DUI arrest last July, his third in the last 3 years, where he was busted driving 50 in a 35-mile-an-hour zone with a blood alcohol content over double the legal limit. In the video, which was posted on the TMZ website, the arresting officer wished him good luck in trying to pass the field sobriety tests that he was about to administer, which Jimmy, I guess, took offense to, thinking that the officer was being sarcastic, when in fact the officer appeared to be genuinely hoping that he would pass his tests. And he called the cop an asshole for it. So the cop apologized. He said he was just trying to be nice. Jimmy wasn't having any of it. According to court documents, he cut a deal earlier this month where he would plead no contest to the charges, and in exchange, he would be required to take several classes. What those classes are, they didn't say. I'm sure they weren't advanced algebra classes. But a source close to Uso told TMZ that he completed those classes earlier last month. So I guess that closes the book on his latest run-in with the law. Until the next one. This week's podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. I know some of you are users of the BetterHelp service. Jimmy Uso could benefit from using it too. Some of you even use my link to sign up after having never heard of BetterHelp before. Let me tell you why you should be using it. Stress is a serious issue. It affects everybody. It affects me. It affects you. It affects everybody you know. Even if you don't think it affects you, trust me, it does. And if you don't take the time to address it, it could lead to all sorts of nasty problems that you don't need. So I decided to give BetterHelp a shot myself to see what it's all about and how it works, because I too have dealt with stress and my sleep habits are not the best, to say the least. And that really screws up the rest of my day when I don't get enough sleep. It affects a whole host of other things. So let me walk you really quickly here through my experience with BetterHelp so far. The first thing they're going to do is ask you a series of questions to match you with the best therapist to help you with whatever your issue may be. It takes a few minutes, but they really get specific about what you're looking for, what type of therapist you'd like to speak with. They say it takes less than 48 hours to match with somebody. I got the email matching me with somebody in less than half an hour. I logged into the website. Immediately, I was messaging with a licensed therapist who was already asking me questions, trying to get to know me a little bit better, sharing a worksheet with me with some helpful tips, and then, you know, already trying to get a live chat scheduled. It was all very easy, especially when you work right from the interface there. From there, I checked her calendar to schedule a live session to have a chat, and the whole process has been very seamless so far. It's customized online therapy. It offers video, phone, even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anybody on camera if you don't want to. You decide how you want to communicate with the other person. I've been messaging back and forth with her after the initial introduction because that's what I feel comfortable with for the time being, but I could change that at any time. I'm telling you, if you've been thinking about trying out therapy, or if you feel weird about it for some reason, don't. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy would be. It's a lot of benefits to giving this a shot as opposed to doing it the traditional way. Give it a try and see if online therapy can help lower your stress. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Solid Monster Sounds Off listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/SolidMonster. That's BetterHelp.com/SolidMonster. Stop thinking about making positive changes in your life and start doing it. BetterHelp.com/SolidMonster. Raw on Monday was, I can't even believe I'm saying this, but this is where we are now, the best WWE show of the week and the most eventful. We had three returns with Asuka confronting Becky Lynch and Mustafa Ali. After being denied his release, he was back interrupting a Miz TV segment with Miz and Austin Theory. Bianca Belair retained her Raw Women's Championship over Sonya Deville. And Randy Orton celebrated 20 years in WWE. I like the opening segment with Orton in the ring, surrounded on the outside by members of the roster, and Riddle in the ring bringing out Cody Rhodes as a special guest for his celebration. It was cool to see Orton and Cody interacting on TV again after so many years apart. That'll be a future pay-per-view program, absolutely. The only question is, does that come before or after Cody wins the championship? That's the only question. If the titles are split again before Cody has a chance to win it, and let's be honest, I mean, there's a good chance that they will be, I would find a way to get that WWE title on Orton first, and then have Cody take the title from Randy Orton. That's, again, assuming they split the titles and Roman keeps his Universal and then you have the WWE title again. If it was somebody other than Roman, I would go with Randy Orton as the guy who Cody beats. Plus, that ties into the idea that I pitched last week for WrestleMania 40. For Cena and Orton to see who can break the record first, and this would push Orton up to number 15. But now I'm booking long term. The opening segment was enjoyable. Orton sounded genuinely grateful for all the attention, and he did what The Undertaker did not do in his Hall of Fame speech. He took the time to thank Mick Foley for what he did for his career. And then he got the parade of interruptions, which led to the 8-man tag team main event with Orton, Riddle, Cody, and Ezekiel, not Elias, against Rollins, Owens, and the Usos. The one thing I would not have done, and it's a minor thing, but it did bother me. They've been booking Veer on television as this uncontrollable monster of a man. Why was he out there clapping and fist-bumping Randy Orton on his way to the ring? Of all the people on the roster, was it really necessary for Veer to be there? It doesn't fit with what they even had him doing on this episode, let alone the past few weeks. Bianca Belair. The good news is that she actually won in her hometown. The bad news is that whatever the hell this was with her and Sonya Deville was really bad and completely nonsensical. So Deville gets counted out 45 seconds into the match. But she says, wait. I slipped on some water on the ground. There was a wet spot. She orders the match to be restarted under no countout rules. 60 seconds later, she gets disqualified for hitting Bianca with a chair. Then she claims that Bianca hit her with her braid first, and that should be considered a weapon, and so she restarts the match again, this time as no countout and no DQ. Then Sonya signals to the back for Carmella and Zelina Vega to come out, and it turns into a 3-on-1 handicap match. But Bianca is able to fight off all three of them. She wins with the KOD on Sonya to retain her title. Now, I know what they were trying to do here. They were trying to give Bianca a big comeback win, fighting off three people. How are we supposed to believe that WWE management is okay with her abusing her power like this week after week? She did the same thing with Naomi for 6 months. Adam Pearce doesn't approve of her actions, but what about his bosses? His bosses and her bosses are one and the same. Evidently, they don't have any issue with her screwing people over left and right for no reason. I mean, I guess the answer is Vince McMahon approves. He is WWE management. I guess he did the same thing to Pat McAfee at WrestleMania. I guess he's just a bad boss. It's just so stupid. It's all so dumb. This did not play out like it was setting up for a rematch either. So, you know, she beats Sonya pretty decisively here. And Becky Lynch has already moved on to her next feud, which makes me wonder if Bayley might be Raw-bound. And if she is, that could be Bianca's next program. You know, when Bayley got hurt last year, remember who it was that she was feuding with at the time? It was Bianca Belair. So that would make Bianca a natural target for her on her way back. They were supposed to have their blow off at Money in the Bank. Bayley got hurt, had to pull out of the match. I'm keep an eye on that. The new name for Edge's new faction is Judgment Day. I like it. The criticisms of the group have gotten to Edge. He worked them into his promo on Monday. He was sitting on his throne in the back. He got a few jabs in, mocking the fans for saying that he uses big words, and he stole The Undertaker's purple lighting. Last week, he injured AJ Styles' arm, the same arm he pointed out where he suffered that separated shoulder in the Royal Rumble match when Edge came back 2 years ago. He wants to see Styles try to hit his phenomenal forearm with one arm. And then Damian Priest spoke about his match with Finn Balor up next. Remember what I said last week after Balor lost the U.S. title to Theory? Balor helping AJ Styles would make a lot of sense, given his recent issues with Damian Priest. Given how things ended up for Balor on this show, I don't think they have any kind of alliance in mind. I think they're just beating Balor like a drum at this point. You would think he had one foot out the door, the way they've been booking him. Edge was sitting on his throne in the aisleway watching Balor's match with Priest when all of a sudden he stood up. And this somehow distracted Finn Balor. He's like a cat. He's easily distracted. Shine a light on the floor and he'll go nuts. This led to Damian Priest hitting a flatliner for the win. The difference in Finn Balor from his last NXT run to how he has been used on the main roster is incredible. It is an incredible transformation, and I mean that in the worst possible way. It's like two completely different people, right down to the way that he wrestles. It's just going through the motions at this point. The arm wrestling contest with Lashley and Omos, I mean, as basic can be. Lashley won, and Omos attacked him after it was over. If there was one surprising thing about this, it's that Omos didn't attack him before the match was over. As Lashley was about to win, yeah, we see the heel beat up the babyface or throw powder in his face. Lashley won first, and then Omos attacked him. He picked up the arm wrestling table. He dropped it on Lashley a few times. Lashley has his work cut out for him at Backlash in that rematch. Lashley is lucky to not be sitting at home with a broken neck, like Big E, after what happened on Thursday at the live event in Newcastle on their European tour. He was wrestling Drew McIntyre, who reversed the power slam attempt that Lashley was going for. He pushed Lashley into the ropes. And Lashley hit the ropes, he bounced off, he tried to clothesline Drew, but Drew ducked, and when Drew hit the ropes, the top rope snapped, just as Lashley was about to hit the ropes on the opposing side, and he took a very scary headfirst spill out onto the floor. But he finished the match, he seemed to be okay, but man, that's a 275-pound man falling out of the ring straight down on his head, with no way to brace himself. He wasn't expecting it. He couldn't put his arms out or anything. He just, I mean, you watch this fan cam video. It is amazing that he did not get hurt. He is a very lucky man. We've seen rope breaks happen before in WWE and other places. I mean, it's not the first time something like this has happened. Just ask Finn Balor. Becky Lynch made her first appearance since losing the Raw Women's title at WrestleMania. She was emotionless, walking down. She looked depressed. At least she didn't have a smile on her face, like a lot of other people do after losing their title. At least she wasn't smiling. Once she opened up her mouth, it was all downhill. And I don't hate the premise of what she's trying to do. The title meant everything to her. There wasn't a day that went by from WrestleMania 35 to 38 when she was active that she was not a champion. And now she doesn't have it anymore, and she's broken. Broken Becky. She doesn't know what to do. But I thought this promo was god-awful. There really has not been a memorable Becky Lynch promo since she came back. I was trying to think, has there been a standout promo since August that I have seen from this woman? The answer is no. Her last run when she was doing the man stuff, I could think back and remember two or three really, you know, memorable ones. Now she's a heel and the whole dynamic is different. And I just can't remember a single promo since the summer that sticks out of my mind. Here it was like she was trying too hard to be Seth Rollins. I can barely tolerate Seth Rollins being Seth Rollins. I don't want somebody else to be Seth Rollins. I don't need Becky Lynch to do Seth Rollins. I mean, she already did Seth Rollins. That's why she was gone for over a year. But you know what I mean. She was laughing maniacally, like a comic book villain. She vowed to be champion again, and nobody would be able to stop her. And all of a sudden, Asuka's music hit and saved us all from any more of this. The ultimate babyface move. So good to see Asuka back. Finally, her first time on television since Money in the Bank last July. She yelled some stuff in Japanese and danced before telling Becky that she would stop her. No one is ready for Asuka. Becky took a swing at her. Asuka avoided it through a spinning back fist that Lynch ducked. We're back to Becky and Asuka again, but it keeps Becky away from the title for a while. She shouldn't even be challenging for it again for a very long time. She had plenty of time with this. She's not going to have another run with it like the one that she just came off of. There's no topping that. So there's no point in rushing her right back into chasing for the championship. It's time to give other people a chance. She put over Bianca, and now Bianca could go work with other people. If Bayley comes back and challenges Bianca, you know, after that, they could go and do Rhea Ripley. Heel Rhea Ripley after joining Judgment Day takes the championship from Bianca Belair at SummerSlam. Book it. The last time we saw Mustafa Ali on television, he lost to Drew McIntyre on the October 29th edition of SmackDown. He cut a promo after that match accusing people of not getting behind him because of his name, which sounded like that was headed to a bad place. But apparently it was Ali's idea for a storyline. Vince McMahon then soured on the idea, whatever it was, and he and Ali reportedly got into a heated argument over the direction of Ali's character that led to McMahon sending Ali home. In January, he announced that he was requesting his release from WWE, and we learned later on that that request was denied. So he's been sitting at home ever since. Supposedly, he's got years left on his contract. But there he was, back on TV on Monday to interrupt a Miz TV segment where Austin Theory, the new United States champion, was being interviewed. He got a, Ali that is, got a tepid reaction, a lukewarm reaction. I guess Mustafa Ali is not over in Knoxville, Tennessee. Honestly, you know, when they played his music, I had no idea whose music they were playing. I had no clue who was coming out. I cannot identify half of these new theme songs or who they're for. Sad. It used to be that no matter who the person was, even if they were low down on the card, I would hear the opening chord and I would know exactly who was coming out. I'm telling you, there must be half the theme music in this company now. I have no idea who it's for. They made fun of Ali as the guy who took his ball and went home. He challenged Theory to a U.S. title match, and when Theory said no, Ali wondered if Theory was all biceps and no balls. That sounds like 85% of the WWF roster during the steroid era. That's what they say. That's what they say, scientifically. They shrivel up your balls. So we ended up getting Ali against The Miz instead, which Ali won when Miz went for the figure four and Ali cradled him, but they didn't give Ali much of a chance to enjoy his fluky win, because as soon as he made it to the entranceway, Tommaso Ciampa rushed in like a bat out of hell and clobbered him. And then they very abruptly cut away to the next segment. Remember when I said that I was shocked that Ciampa actually survived the recent string of name changes? He got to keep his name. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that he made it through without them calling him Tommy Tortellini. I spoke too soon. Now, it's not that bad. He's still Ciampa, but he is no longer Tommaso. Like so many before him, they have taken his first name hostage. Even Robert Stone on NXT this week, I don't know if you noticed, they were referring to him as Mr. Stone, because Robert is his real first name. No more Robert. Now he's just Mr. Stone. Another name, taken hostage. Tommaso is now chained to the wall in the basement of Titan Tower, next to Antonio, Alexander, Buddy, Matt, and Robert. But as name changes go, this is probably the least offensive one that I've seen. Raquel Gonzalez being Raquel Rodriguez is not bad either. It's just so silly. It's so silly to see so many of them happening all at the same time, after going by one name on their show for so long, all of a sudden it's just this mass wave of changes. It's just stupid. I like Ciampa as a heel. He had his greatest run in NXT as a heel. I'm all for bringing that Ciampa back. And Ali is better as a babyface than a heel. As a heel, he was miscast. So they got that part of it right as far as the roles, but because they brought back Ali does not mean they have any actual plan for Ali. They probably figured, look, if this guy's just going to sit home, we're already paying him. May as well get some use out of him. Then it was time for our 8-man tag team main event, and there is no wrestling company on the planet better than WWE when it comes to stretching for time on television. Cody Rhodes made his way out at 10:27 p.m. The actual match did not begin until after 10:40. That was after a bunch of other segments they stuck in there and a couple of commercials. You know, if you're watching a show that's 2 hours long, as most wrestling shows are, if it's really good and you're into it, it doesn't necessarily feel like 2 hours. You might turn around, and this happens a lot with Dynamite, frankly. Even if it isn't necessarily the best episode of Dynamite, I turn around sometimes and I see that the first hour is gone. It's like 9:05, 9:10, and it doesn't feel like it. SmackDown used to be like that. Now SmackDown is shit. The thing about Raw, even on a good week like this, it feels like a 3 hour show. And that's how they format it. They format it the exact same way. The main event, though, I thought was fun. It felt like a house show match to send the crowd home happy. This was all about celebrating Randy Orton and building him, tagging into the match. That was the big moment it was building to. Randy Orton gets the hot tag. It was RKO City at the finish. RKO to Rollins, RKO to Owens, RKO to Jimmy, RKO to Jay for the win. He countered an Uso splash with an RKO, which looked great. A crowd-pleasing finish to a mostly good episode of Raw. Now, on SmackDown, there's only one thing worth even talking about here. You want the full SmackDown review, it's up on the channel. And I pushed the audio out as well. The only thing of note at all from SmackDown on Friday was the change in the tag team title match at Backlash. We were scheduled for a contract signing for the winner-take-all tag team title unification match between RK-Bro and the Usos. It ended up in a brawl. Roman Reigns came out to assist his cousins. Roman Reigns ended up ripping the contract up and stuffing it in Riddle's mouth. This was before the contract was even signed. Nobody had signed it. And Roman went and he ripped it up. He's beaten them down. Here comes Drew McIntyre. So now we know what Roman's next feud is going to be. Drew McIntyre dispatches the Usos. He had a stare down with Roman. They traded blows in the ring. Drew threw him across the ring with a belly-to-belly overhead suplex, and the bloodline retreated. And I said on the stream on Friday, it was very sad watching the fan cam footage of this from the taping last week. This was a tape show on Friday. A lot of people had already left the building for the second taping. But the people even who were there weren't even reacting. Drew and Roman coming to blows for the first time in so long. This is going to be your next big world title feud. And nobody seemed to give a shit. At least not that night in the building. But the contract was never signed and then it got ripped up. Which had me thinking, okay, maybe they're going to turn it into a six-man winner-take-all match. Well, they did turn it into a six-man tag. Paul Heyman went to Adam Pearce after and said, how about this? How about a Backlash we do Roman Reigns and the Usos against Drew McIntyre, Randy Orton, and Riddle? And since then, it has been made official. The unification match at Backlash is off. And in its place, it'll be just a straight six-man tag team match, Roman Reigns, Jimmy and Jay, against McIntyre and RK-Bro. No mention of it being winner-take-all, no mention of it being unification. They just spent the last few weeks promoting and advertising a winner-take-all unification match at the pay-per-view that no longer exists. The good news about them doing a six-man tag is that's their way around jumping right into a singles match between Roman Reigns and Drew McIntyre. Now, they've been doing singles matches on a lot of the live events, even on the European tour this week. It's Roman against Drew. Roman hits a spear and he beats him. So they've been doing that house show program now for a while. But in terms of the first time you're putting these two in the ring for the championship, it should not be happening with 1 week build on a B-level pay-per-view. This gets them out of doing the singles match, at least delaying it until Hell in a Cell. Maybe Money in the Bank. I don't think they can get to SummerSlam without doing it. But at least it buys them another month. That's one of the good things about turning this into a six-man tag. Of course, the insane part of this is if they don't add the winner-take-all stipulation to the match, which I think they're going to do this week. That's why I'm not going in too hard on it, because we have two shows left. The Bloodline is being advertised for Raw on Monday. We have Raw Monday. We have SmackDown on Friday. I believe they will ultimately add the stipulation in that all titles are on the line. SmackDown tag titles are on the line. Raw tag team titles are on the line. And Roman's titles are on the line. Winner take all. Bloodline wins. and they unify all the gold. That's how I see it going, assuming the stipulation gets added. Now, if the stipulation does not get added, first of all, that's pretty fucking terrible that they advertised this major stip and then they took it away. But if they take the stip away and it's just a straight six-man, I could see the babyfaces going over. Give the babyfaces a win. Sets up Drew as more of a threat to Roman. I'm not so sure that Drew is going to beat Roman when they do go one-on-one. But it all depends on what the stipulation is, if any, for this six-man tag team match. They should still make it winner-take-all. That puts stakes on the line. It creates, you know, a situation where, okay, this is a pretty exciting main event here. All the gold is on the line. There's something at stake here. That's what I think they should be doing. I think we'll probably get the announcement this week. This is WWE. They've disappointed me many times before. But I have a feeling they'll add that stipulation in this week. The point that I made on the stream on Friday, regardless of what they do on television this week, the biggest thing that made absolutely no sense and made this so stupid, Roman Reigns is the one who sent the Usos on a mission to go to Raw in the first place a couple of weeks ago and said, I want those titles. Bring me those titles. You're going to unify those tag team titles. He's the reason they even went there in the first place, to unify them. And yet Roman was the one who ripped up the contract before they even had a chance to sign it. What? What? Per this week's Observer, there are at least talks of NXT returning to Full Sail University. This was almost a throwaway line in the newsletter. There was no context to it. There was no further word on it. So we don't know if the talks are related to them doing some sort of a nostalgic, you know, comeback event at Full Sail one time, or if the talks are about bringing NXT television weekly back to Full Sail. I like Full Sail. I get a little nostalgic for it also if I go back and watch any of those older NXT shows. The crowd was kind of getting on my nerves there at the end, but you know, then the pandemic happened and everything went to hell, and I do kind of miss the old NXT shows being in that building, but it doesn't make much sense that they've invested all that money in remodeling the performance center and creating their own little arena and all the money on the lighting and everything they've done there with the screens just to go back to Full Sail. It makes no sense. So maybe it is something where they would go back to Full Sail occasionally just for old time's sake. But in terms of running weekly television there, I don't see that happening at all. Now, this 2.0 show on Tuesday, the match between Nikita Lyons and Lash Legend is what happens when you have the blind leading the blind. Lyons is better in the ring than Lash is, although that doesn't mean that either one of them are very good. It's why I said Natalya should be working with Nikita. I said that 3 weeks ago. Wade Barrett lost whatever credibility he had left when he referred to this match as a banger. He called it a banger. Yes. If he meant that it caused me to want to bang my head against the wall, then sure, it was a banger. But I don't think he knows what that word means. They screwed up a crisscross spot, which was hilarious to watch. There was a chin lock in there I think they messed up, and Lash dumped Nikita through the ropes at one point, and Lyons came straight down on her head. I shrieked when I saw it. It's not often I scream out loud when I see something. I shrieked when I saw this. I actually put my hands over my mouth when I saw her go head first down on the floor. Referee jumped out of the ring to go check on her, make sure everything was okay. Oh my God. They seem to settle down a little bit near the end, but these two have no business being in the ring together. They gain nothing from it when they should be working with people who actually know what they're doing. So, of course, next week, they're going to be back in the ring together again. At least it'll be a tag team match. Natty attacked Nikita after she won. Cora Jade ran out to make the save. And so on their spring breakin' show, this Tuesday, it's going to be Jade and Lyons against Natty and Lash Legend. The Viking Raiders are the latest main roster import to the NXT roster, the one brand where they can actually win a match. They gave them a win over Idris Enofe and Malik Blade to set up their match with the Creed brothers. It's going to be the Vikings and the Creeds this Tuesday. Robert Stone, who was out there managing Von Wagner for his match with Tony D'Angelo, has apparently lost his first name. As I mentioned earlier, they referred to him as Mr. Stone. Nathan Fraser from NXT UK was to have made his debut on this show, but Grayson Waller attacked his opponent before the match could begin, which now leads to Fraser making his debut against Waller at Spring Breakin'. They announced the start of the breakout tournament for the ladies in 2 weeks. They've done these, I think two of them before for the men, never for the women. One of the participants in the women's breakout tournament is Santino Marella's daughter, Bianca, who has been given the name Ariana Grace. I enjoyed the match with Katana Chance. I enjoyed the match with Katana Chance and Caden Carter against Yulisa Leon and Valentina Feroz. Chance and Carter have turned into one of the best women's tag teams they have. I like a lot of their double team offense. And I have been impressed by what little I've seen from Leon and Feroz in the handful of appearances I've seen of theirs. I think there's promise there. I've seen maybe three of their matches so far, but I like them, and I like this match. I like this more than anything else on the entire show. We got a vignette showing Wes Lee of MSK on a beach. Of course, he lost his tag team partner. It's very sad. He was on a beach looking out into the ocean and the skyline, talking about his six-month journey back to the NXT tag team titles and how it sucked to lose them. He said he'll never forget his past. He can complain about things, how they're not fair, or he can knuckle up and make waves. Get it? Because he was on the beach. I see what they did there. So they're going to give it a go with Wes Lee as far as a singles push. I hope it works out. He's very talented. And he was put in a situation that was not one of his own making. He did nothing wrong. It's like Ember Moon in the interview with Chris Van Vliet when they took her off TV. They told her, you didn't do anything wrong. She did nothing wrong. And yet she got fucked over. He shouldn't be punished for something that he had no part in. Mandy Rose beat Roxanne Perez. Ah, look at Roxy. Only her second match and they already have her in the ring with the NXT Women's Champion. I'm not very keen on beating her already. A lot of this was, you know, roll-ups and the like. I wouldn't say she came off as her equal or anything. They're booking her as the scrappy underdog. Then came the post-match stuff with Wendy Chu, Pajama Girl, dropping a net over the members of Toxic Attraction to trap them in the aisle, which then led to Chu and Perez shooting silly string at them and chasing them away. You smell that? Do you smell that? You know what that is? It's wrestle crap. That's what that smell is. But the shit brigade wasn't over just yet. They must have had a bad case of food poisoning in these last few segments because the shit was flying everywhere. You've heard of projectile vomiting, right? This was like projectile shitting all over my television screen. They closed the show with Joe Gacy in the ring for a monologue, surrounded at ringside by all of his developmental druids, which is enough to get me to want to change the channel, but I stuck with it. Where do druids train, by the way? I was wondering this. As I watched all of these druids, is there like a druid academy of some sort where you learn to like wear the cloak, walk around really slow, walk around without tripping over the cloak? What is involved in this training? Who are the trainers? Do they have druid trainers? Is it the old druids from The Undertaker in like 1994? Now they're all retired and now they're training the next generation of druids? I would love to know more about this. They could do a whole reality show based on this. Put it up on their YouTube channel. He rambled on, did Gacy, for a bit. Said Bron Breakker wasn't cleared to compete in their title match next week after his little fall last week. He was interrupted by Rick Steiner, who got into the ring and said, "You've got it all wrong. My son is cleared to compete next week." And Gacy was threatening physical harm to the old man when all the druids climbed up on the apron to surround him, and that is when Bron Breakker had seen enough. I guess he was standing in the back on a monitor watching all of this unfold. He walked out. It begs the question, if Braun was standing there ready to come out, why did he send his father out there to potentially get hurt? He was already kidnapped. Has his father not been through enough? Why wouldn't he just come out and beat the fuck out of this guy himself? He sent his father out there to be surrounded by 15 druids. Two of the druids had Steiner pinned up against the buckles in the corner they were restraining him, while Gacy took Breaker down with a lariat, and then he posed with the NXT Championship as they went off the air. So Spring Breakin' this Tuesday has Breaker against Gacy for the title. Cameron Grimes defends the North American Championship against Carmelo Hayes and Solo Sikoa. The Creed brothers take on the Vikings. Nathan Fraser takes on Grayson Waller. Natty and Lash Legend against Nikita Lyons and Cora Jade. And a sit-down with Tony D'Angelo and Santos Escobar. Riveting stuff. Let's go to the mailbag, because I got a bunch of questions from you guys. The biggest mailbag I've done in months. These are all questions from you. TheSolemonster@gmail.com is the email address. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. I had to leave out a few who did not include that information. Blake from Birmingham, Alabama. I've got a question about the so-called casual fan. Why do you think people are so obsessed with wrestling promotions going after the casual fan? I've never heard of any other sport or television show working to get casual fans for their product. Why is it this way for wrestling? I feel like people are wanting the fans that were around during the Monday Night War. There were way more casual viewers back then because it was so popular that if you weren't a wrestling fan, you were out of the loop on what was popular back then. But today's wrestling isn't as popular and never will be, and yet people are still looking for the casual fan. Brother, that's all that it is. You hit the nail right on the head. People wanting a return to that late 90s Attitude Era period where wrestling was hot, and their friends, you know, the ones who used to mock them for being a wrestling fan, all of a sudden they were asking them about what happened on Raw and what happened on Nitro the night before. That's all that it is. And the same thing happened to me, by the way. I had a friend, name was Jeff, I don't know where he is now, I hope he's doing well. Wasn't a wrestling fan, like I was with my best friend, and then I can remember it was some big NWO angle on Nitro, and I can remember being in class the next day. And here comes Jeff, and he's like, hey, did you see what happened on WCW last night? I go, oh, all of a sudden somebody's interested in what's going on the wrestling show. Because it was the popular thing. But that's what people are trying to do. They're trying to recapture a period of time that no longer exists. And, you know, I know he's taking a very negative approach by saying, never again. He's not wrong. He's not wrong. We will never return to that period the way that it was. But people will constantly, it's like chasing the dragon, chasing the ghost. They're chasing for something that's not there. They're chasing for something that they will never be able to get back. They're living in the past. It's exactly what it is. Zach from Kent, England. Would it be a good idea for an AEW wrestler to win any New Japan championship at the Forbidden Door show and let somebody from New Japan win it back in next year's Wrestle Kingdom? If New Japan still had its Intercontinental title, I think it would be sick if either Bryan Danielson or Jon Moxley could win it and then lose it to Kota Ibushi, but since it's no longer possible, what if Wheeler Yuta won the junior heavyweight title and lost it to Zack Sabre Jr. in January? You could do it. It would have to be a lesser name like Yuta as opposed to someone like Moxley or Danielson, because I don't know that Tony Khan would be able to send any of his big names. Or yeah, it would take them out of the country. It would take them away from his own shows for at least a week, maybe two. I think it's way too early to know how things are going to be there COVID-wise. I think to make any plans now for AEW names or Wrestle Kingdom, but I'd love to see it. You know, even if someone won one of the titles and lost it later in the year, not necessarily at Wrestle Kingdom, I think that would be great. Mark from Massachusetts, I know you said you have no desire to see Stone Cold Steve Austin back in the ring again, and we both agree it is highly unlikely. But for fun, let's say you are Vince McMahon, what do you think the perfect pitch would be? The perfect pitch would be for one last title chase. That would be the perfect pitch. He's already done the comeback match. CM Punk ain't around. Otherwise, that would be the match to do. There's really nobody else on the roster just in terms of a straight, you know, special attraction that I am dying to see Stone Cold climb into the ring with. Brock Lesnar would fucking murder him. I want to see Austin leave in one piece. I think that you would have to do the comeback story. He would have a whole story arc that gets him to one last title shot. Whether he wins or loses isn't even really relevant. I mean, the story would be in the chase. He may have to win another Royal Rumble just to get there. That would be his fourth one if he did. And then we would get Austin against Roman Reigns at WrestleMania. To me, that would be the perfect pitch. Nir from Israel. When the day comes where Randy Orton will enter the WWE Hall of Fame, who do you think should induct him? I can think of so many names. Edge, Cena, Foley, Cowboy Bob Orton, and both members of Legacy. Hell, even Riddle could be a good choice if RK-Bro continues to be a thing. Orton may not be going into the Hall of Fame for another 10 to 15 years. I doubt RK-Bro will be a thing for that much longer. Those are all fine choices. I would go with Triple H. Triple H and John Cena are his two greatest rivals. Triple H, though, is the one who handpicked him for Evolution. He's the one who gave him his first big break, helped launch him as a star. So it should be Triple H. Steve from Virginia. Can you explain why Scott Hall was in ECW for a short period of time? Were there any long-term plans for him in ECW? And why was he only featured at a house show? You would think one of the biggest names in WCW would draw a lot, so why not debut him at a pay-per-view? I would love to hear more about this small period of Scott Hall's career. There really wasn't much to it. I mean, he wasn't brought in for a run. They couldn't afford him, even if they wanted him. ECW was on its last legs by that point. That was, what was that, November of 2000, I think, right? It was around there, and I think 2 months later, they ran their final show. Hall had finished up with WCW months earlier. His friend Justin Credible worked for ECW. I think it was just something he did for fun. You know, they paid him whatever they paid him for it. But like you said, it was just a house show. Actually, it was two house shows, back-to-back nights. And he did a job on the second night for one of their home talents. I don't think there was ever any serious discussion of him coming in for any sort of a run beyond that. That's why you never saw him on pay-per-view. It was just a one-off thing at a pair of house shows. He was free, he wanted to come in and do it, and that was it. Now, when Paul Heyman brought in Sid Vicious the year before, that was different. I think he debuted him on pay-per-view. Sid stuck around for a few months, he did some TVs. And he would have stayed had Heyman agreed to pay him something like $250,000, I think is what Sid was looking for. And even then, ECW was having money issues. They weren't paying Sid $250,000 a year even if they wanted to. Jacob from Texas, the Lone Star State. With reports coming out that Vince McMahon sees Austin Theory as a John Cena-type wrestler, do you think he could be the one to beat Roman Reigns for the championship? Theory is a good wrestler, but he's not the biggest guy on either roster. I can't see Vince having someone his size beat Reigns. What do you think? Cody Rhodes isn't much bigger. And he's going to be the champion one day. So, to me, the size thing is a non-issue. But no, Austin Theory is not going to be the one to beat Roman Reigns. We're a ways off from a Theory babyface turn. I don't see that happening at all. Isaac from Campbellton, New Brunswick. After the Observer recently mentioned that Daniel Garcia was considered to join the Blackpool Combat Club, I was wondering if there is any more AEW talent, male or female, who you think would be a good fit for the faction. Yeah, I mean, female-wise, Serena Deeb doesn't really need to be in there, but she would be a good fit. A few people have mentioned Layla Hirsch to me. I can see that too. Selfishly, I would like to see Claudio Cesaro wind up signing a contract, whether it's mostly with Ring of Honor or if it's with AEW, whatever. But I'd like to see him come in and be part of that group. He's not a young guy to take under their wing. I just think the trio of you know, Moxley, Danielson, and Cesaro, led by William Regal, just sounds fucking awesome. Clark from Medicine Hat. Chris Benoit on his DVD said he was offered to join the WWF in 1995, but he turned it down because the company then was more about Bret and Shawn and the big guys. He thought he would have been out of place. That's why he went to WCW. If he had gone to the WWF at that time, do you think he would have just been a tag team specialist or what? I think that they would have had plans for him as a singles star. When they brought him in, he had at least one dark match. He might have had more. But I know because there's a photo of it. He had at least one dark match where they had Ted DiBiase managing him. So that tells me that they may have had him in mind to be managed by DiBiase because Benoit was not... Benoit really was never a strong promo. But back then in 95, I don't even think he could speak. So maybe they would have brought him in. He would have been part of the Million Dollar Corporation. DiBiase would have been his mouthpiece. So no, I think they would have had him in line for a singles push, not for a tag team run. And finally here, Dallas from Minnesota. During the Wyatt family's run, if Sister Abigail were there to be an on-screen character, who do you think would have been perfect to play her? Oh, I think Daphne could have rocked that role. Daphne never had a run in WWE, but I think she could have rocked it in that role. She would have been a much better fit for that than some of the other names that were floating around at the time. Fucking, you know, they had... One of the names they had was... I know Paige was one. I heard Eva Marie's name mentioned. Just some, like, Looney Tunes shit. My God, can you imagine Eva Marie as Sister Abigail? If it was going to be somebody, it should have been someone we had never seen before in WWE. But when I look back on all that stuff, you know, turning Sister Abigail into an actual person, I think it would have ruined the whole point. It would have ruined the whole story. It was never meant to be a physical manifestation of Sister Abigail. And I was pitching ideas for it at the time, too. But again, I look back on it now with the benefit of hindsight. It's better off they never had anyone playing Sister Abigail. It would have been completely just counter to what I think the whole premise of there being a Sister Abigail was. Would have ruined the whole point of it. Then again, they did a pretty good job of ruining the Wyatt family anyway. Keep sending me your questions. Feed me more. TheSolomonster at gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Solomonster. Instagram is at TheSolomonster. And become a YouTube channel member. That way you get access when we do those call-in shows. You can go back and listen to the one from Thursday. There's other perks and emojis and all kinds of fun stuff there. I will be live on YouTube this week on Wednesday night and Friday night, as I am each and every single week. Next Sunday is episode 755, and it's also WrestleMania Backlash. And so I will have to figure out when I'm going to do predictions. I might just do the Backlash predictions on the SmackDown stream Friday night, but we'll talk about the predictions next Sunday as well. We'll do WrestleMania Backlash predictions next weekend. So you'll get two podcasts in one day next Sunday. You'll get the main podcast, and then you'll get the Backlash recap after the show is over. So a lot of good stuff coming up in the month of May. I hope you guys have yourselves a great week. And I will see you back here for episode 755 next Sunday. So until then, have a great week. Take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
I just heard from the board of directors. I just got a text message on my phone. That's all Adam Pearce ever does when we see him or Sonya Deville on TV. That's all they're doing. They're on their phones. I always wonder, well, who exactly are they texting? Who are they talking to on the phone in the middle of this live television show? They're supposed to be paying attention to what's going on in the building. They shouldn't be on the phone having conversations during those 2 hours or 3 hours. Who are they texting or sexting? Maybe I don't want to know.
The Solomonster sounds off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster. Solomonster sounds off.